tears. Beth. Beth, darling. Finally they left, their sad eyes caressing her face. I felt terrible. They weren't saying anything derogatory to me, never once complaining or accusing, yet over the years, most doctors learn to grasp unstated emotions. We also understand some of what hurting relatives go through. I was hurting inside for little Beth, and I couldn't do one thing more for her. All I could do was keep her vital signs steady and wait for her brain to heal. Both John and I remained optimistic, and we tried to reassure them by saying, "She's going to come back. Beth's just like the kids who have had severe head trauma and their brainstems swell. Sometimes they're out for days, even weeks or months, but they come back." They wanted to believe me, and I could see they were hanging on to every word of comfort Dr. Freeman or I, or the nurses, could give. Yet I still didn't think they believed us. Despite the fact that John and I believed what we told Beth's parents, we couldn't be positive that Beth would wake up or that she wouldn't, finally, just slip away. We'd never been in that particular situation before, yet we couldn't really account for Beth's condition in any other way except that the brainstem was traumatized. The condition wasn't so severe that she couldn't bounce back, yet the days passed and Beth didn't bounce back. She stayed in a comatose condition for 2 weeks. Daily, I examined Beth and checked her records, and it became harder every day to walk into the room and face her parents. They looked at me with despair, no longer daring to hope. Time after time, I had to say, "No change yet." And I meant yet, despite what was happening. Everybody on the staff remained supportive, constantly offering encouragement to the ushers. They also encouraged me as I began to grow concerned. Other doctors, even nurses, would come to me and say, "It's going to be all right, Ben." It's always inspiring when other people try to help. They knew me, and just from my silence, they figured out what troubled me. Despite their optimistic words, it was a tough time for all of us involved with Beth Usher. Finally, Beth improved slightly, enough that she didn't have to be on a respirator, but she remained comatose. We released her from ICU and sent her down to the regular floor. The ushers spent as much time with her as they possibly could, regularly talking to her or playing videos for her. Beth had especially liked the TV program Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood, so they played videotapes of Mr. Rogers. When he heard about Beth, Fred Rogers himself even came to visit Beth. He stood by her bed, touched her hand, talked to her. But her face showed no expression, and she didn't wake up. One night her dad was lying on a cot in the room, unable to sleep. It was nearly 2 o'clock in the morning. "Daddy, my nose itches." "What?" he cried, jumping out of his cot. "My nose itches." "Beth talked! Beth talked!" Brian Usher ran into the hallway, so excited that he didn't realize he was wearing only underpants. I doubt that anyone cared anyway. "Her nose itches!" he yelled at the nurse. The medical staff raced after him to the room. Beth lay quietly, a smile on her face. "It does itch. A lot." Those words were the beginning of Beth's recovery. After that, she started getting better every day. In 1988, Beth's parents reported to me that she has continued to improve. She was number one in her math class. Beth has a slight left limp. In common with other hemispherectomies, she has limited peripheral vision on one side because the visual cortex is bilateral. The one side controls vision to the other side. For some reason, vision doesn't seem to transfer. The limp has been there in every case. Each of the hemispherectomies is a story in itself. For instance, I think of 13-year-old Denise Baca from New Mexico. Denise came to us in status epilepticus, meaning she was seizing constantly. Because she had been in constant seizure for 2 months, she had to be on a respirator. Unable to control her breathing because of the constant convulsions, Denise had undergone a tracheotomy. Now paralyzed on one side, she hadn't spoken for several months. Denise had been a perfectly normal child a few years earlier. Her parents took her to all the New Mexico medical centers that would examine her, and then to other parts of the country. All experts concluded that her primary seizure focus was from the speech area, Broca's area, and from the motor cortex, the two most important sections of her dominant hemisphere. There is nothing that can be done for her, a doctor finally told her parents. Those might have been the final words, except that a family friend read one of the articles about Miranda Francisco. Immediately, she called Denise's parents. The mother, in turn, called Johns Hopkins. "Bring Denise here, and we'll evaluate her situation," we said. Transporting her from New Mexico to Baltimore was no easy task because Denise was on a respirator, which required a medevac, a special transport system. But they made it. After we evaluated Denise, controversy broke out here at Hopkins over whether to do a hemispherectomy. Several neurologists sincerely thought we would be crazy to attempt such an operation. They had good reasons for their opinions. Number one, Denise was too old. Number two, the seizures were coming from areas that made surgery risky, if not impossible. Number three, she was in terrible medical condition because of her seizures. Denise had aspirated, so she was having pulmonary problems as well. One critic in particular predicted, "She'll likely die on the table just from the medical problems, much less from a hemispherectomy." He wasn't trying to be difficult, but voiced his opinion out of deep and sincere concern. Doctors Freeman, Vining, and I didn't agree. As the three people directly involved with all the hemispherectomies at Hopkins, we had had quite a bit of experience, and we were confident that we knew more about hemispherectomies than anyone else. We reasoned that, better than anyone else at Hopkins, we ought to know her chances. She would certainly die soon without surgery. Further, despite her other medical problems, she was still a viable candidate for a hemispherectomy. And finally, we reasoned that we three ought to be the ones to determine who was a candidate. We talked with our critic through several conferences, supporting our arguments with the evidence and experience from our background cases. We have a conference office where we invite more than just our inner circle. Over a period of days, we presented all the evidence we could and involved any of the staff at Hopkins whom we thought might have an interest in Denise's condition. Because of the controversy, we delayed doing the operation. Normally, we would have gone ahead and done it, but we faced so much opposition we took this one slowly and carefully. Our opposition deserved a fair hearing, although we insisted upon the final word. The neurologist critic went so far as to write a letter to the chairman of neurosurgery, with copies to the chairman of surgery, the hospital president, and a few other people. He stated that, in his medical opinion, under no circumstances should Johns Hopkins allow this operation. He then carefully explained his reasons. Perhaps it was inevitable that bad feelings developed over Denise's case. When these issues become important, it's hard to keep personal feelings out of the picture. Because I believed in the critic's sincerity and his concern for not involving Hopkins in any extraordinary and heroic ventures, I never took his arguments as personal indictments. While I was able to stay out of any personal controversy, a few of our team members and supportive friends did get heatedly involved. Despite all arguments he brought forth, the three of us remained convinced that Denise's only chance lay in having the surgery. We had not been forbidden to do the surgery, and no one higher up had taken any action on the objection, giving us the freedom to make our decision. Yet we hesitated, not wanting to make this a personal issue, feeling that if we did, the controversy could erupt and affect the morale of the entire hospital staff. For days, I asked God to help us resolve this problem. I pondered it as I drove back and forth to work. I prayed about it as I made my rounds, and when I knelt by my bed at night. Yet I couldn't see how it would work out. Then the issue resolved itself. Our critic left for a 5-day overseas conference. While he was gone, we decided to do the operation. It seemed like a golden opportunity, and we wouldn't have any loud outcries. I explained to Mrs. Baca, as I did to others, if we don't do anything, she's going to die. If we do something, she may die, but at least we have a chance. At least the operation gives her a fighting chance, her mother said. The parents were amenable and had been all along. They understood the issue perfectly. Denise was seizing so much and deteriorating so badly, it was becoming a race against time. After the hemispherectomy, Denise remained comatose for a few days, and then she awakened. She had stopped seizing. By the time she was ready to go home, she was starting to talk. Weeks later, Denise returned to school and has progressed nicely ever since. I didn't have any animosity toward the fellow who caused the opposition, because he strongly believed that surgery was the wrong thing to do. It was his prerogative to raise objections. By his objections, he thought he was looking out for the patient's best interests as well as those of the institution. The situation with Denise taught me two things. First, it made me feel that the good Lord won't allow me to get into a situation he can't get me out of. Second, it confirmed in me that when people know their capabilities and they know their material or job, it doesn't matter who opposes them. Regardless of the reputation of the critics or their popularity, power, or how much they think they know, their opinions become irrelevant. I honestly never had any doubts about Denise's surgery. In the months afterwards, although I didn't know it at the time, I would do other and more controversial surgeries. Looking back, I believe that God had used the controversy over Denise to prepare me for the steps yet ahead. Chapter 17. Three Special Children. The resident flicked off his penlight and straightened up from the bedside of Bobo Valentine. "Don't you think it's time to give up on this little girl?" he asked, nodding toward the 4-year-old child. It was early Monday morning, and I was making rounds. When I came to Bobo, the house officer explained her situation. "Just about the only thing she has left is her pupillary response," he said. That meant that her pupils still responded to light. The light he shone in her eyes told him that pressure had built inside her head. The doctors had put Bobo in a barbiturate coma and given her hyperventilation, but still couldn't keep the pressures down. Little Bobo was another of the far too many children who run out into a street and are hit by a car. A good humor truck struck Bobo. She'd lain in the ICU all weekend, comatose, and with an intracranial pressure monitor in her skull. Her blood pressure gradually worsened, and she was losing what little function, purposeful movement, and response to stimuli she had. Before answering the resident, I bent over Bobo and lifted her eyelids. Her pupils were fixed and dilated. "I thought you told me the pupils were still working," I said in astonishment. "I did," he protested. "They were working just before you came in." "You're telling me this just happened? That her eyes just now dilated?" "They must have. 4+ emergency," I called loudly but calmly. "We've got to do something right away." I turned to the nurse standing behind me. "Call the operating room. We're on our way." 4+ emergency," she called even louder and hurried down the corridor. Although rare, a +4, for dire emergency, galvanizes everyone into action. The OR staff clears out a room and starts getting the instruments ready. They work with quiet efficiency, and they're quick. No one argues, and no one has time to explain. 2 residents grabbed Bobo's bed and half ran down the hallway. Fortunately, surgery hadn't started on the scheduled patient, so we bumped the case. On my way to the operating room, I ran into another neurosurgeon, senior to me, and a man I highly respect because of his work with trauma accidents. While the staff was setting up, I explained to him what had happened and what I was going to do. "Don't do it," he said as he walked away from me. "You're wasting your time." His attitude amazed me, but I didn't dwell on it. Bobo Valentine was still alive. We had a chance, extremely small, but still a chance to save her life. I decided I would go ahead and do surgery anyway. Bobo was gently positioned on an egg crate, a soft, flexible pad covering the operating table, and was covered with a pale green sheet. Within minutes, the nurses and anesthesiologist had her ready for me to begin. I did a craniectomy. First, I opened her head and took off the front portion of her skull. The skull bone was put in a sterile solution. Then I opened up the covering of her brain, the dura. Between the 2 halves of the brain is an area called the falx. By splitting the falx, the 2 halves could communicate together and equalize the pressure between her hemispheres. Using cadaveric dura, dura from a dead person, I sewed it over her brain. This gave her brain room to swell, then heal, and still held everything inside her skull in place. Once I covered the area, I closed the scalp. The surgery took about 2 hours. Bobo remained comatose for the next few days. It is heartbreaking to watch parents sit by the bedside of a comatose child, and I felt for them. I could only give them hope. I couldn't promise Bobo's recovery. One morning I stopped by her bed and noted that her pupils were starting to work a little bit. I recall thinking, maybe something positive is starting to happen. After 2 more days, Bobo started moving a little. Sometimes she stretched her legs or shifted her body as if trying to get more comfortable. Over the course of a week, she grew alert and responsive. When it became apparent that she was going to recover, we took her back to surgery, and I replaced the portion of her skull that had been removed. Within 6 weeks, Bobo was, once again, a normal 4-year-old girl, vivacious, bouncy, and cute. This is another instance when I'm glad I didn't listen to a critic. I've actually done 1 craniectomy since then. Again, I encountered opposition. In the summer of 1988, we had a similar situation, except that Charles, for the sake of privacy, I've changed his name, age 10, was in worse shape. He had been hit by a car. When the head nurse told me that Charles's pupils had become fixed and dilated, that meant we had to take action. The clinic was especially busy that day, so I sent the senior resident to explain to the mother that, in my judgment, we ought to take Charles to the operating room immediately. We would remove a portion of his brain as a last-ditch effort to save his life. It may not work, the resident told her, but Dr. Carson thinks it's worth a try. The poor mother was distraught and shocked. Absolutely not, she cried. I can't let you do it. You will not do that to my boy. Just let him die in peace. You're not going to be playing around with my kid. But this way we have a chance. A chance? I want more than a chance. She kept shaking her head. Let him go. Her response was reasonable. By then, Charles wasn't responding to anything. Only 3 days earlier, we had regretfully told her that Charles's condition was so serious that he would probably not recover, and she should come to grips with the inevitable end. Then suddenly, a man stood before her, urging her to give her consent to a radical procedure. The resident could give her no assurance that Charles would recover or even be better. After the resident returned and repeated the conversation, I went to see Charles's mother. I spent a long time explaining in detail that we weren't going to cut the boy in pieces. She still hesitated. Let me tell you about a similar situation we had here, I said. She was a sweet little girl named Bobo. When I finished, I added, Look, I don't know about this surgery. It may not work, but I don't see that we can give up in a situation where we still have even a glimmer of hope. Maybe it's the smallest chance of hope, but we can't just throw it away, can we? The worst thing that could happen is that Charles dies anyway. Once she understood exactly what I would do, she said, You mean there really is a chance? A possibility that Charles might live? A chance, yes, if we do surgery. Without it, no chance whatsoever. In that case, she said, Of course I want you to try. I just didn't want you cutting him up when it didn't make any difference. Not defending ourselves that we don't do such things, I again emphasized that this was the only chance we could offer her. She signed the consent form immediately. We rushed the boy off to the operating room. As with Bobo, it involved removing a portion of the skull, cutting between the 2 halves of the brain, covering the swollen brain with cadaveric dura, and sewing the scalp back up. As expected, Charles remained comatose afterward, and for a week, nothing changed. More than one staff member said something to me like, The ball game's over, we're wasting our time. Someone presented Charles's case in our neurosurgical grand rounds. Neurosurgery grand rounds is a weekly conference attended by all neurosurgeons and residents to discuss interesting cases. Previously scheduled for an important surgery, I couldn't be present. But I was told what was said by several who had been in on the conference. What do you think? The attending doctor asked one intern. Isn't this going a little beyond the call of duty? Another one said, quite firmly, I think it was a foolish thing to do. Others agreed. One of the attending neurosurgeons, familiar with the boy's condition, stated, These types of situations never result in anything good. Another said, This patient has not yet recovered, and he's not going to recover. In my opinion, it's inappropriate to attempt a craniectomy. Would they have been so vocal if I had been present? I'm not sure, yet they were speaking from their own conviction. and since 7 days had passed with no change, their skepticism was understandable. Maybe I'm just stubborn, or maybe I inwardly knew the boy still had a fighting chance. At any rate, I wasn't ready to give up. On the 8th day, a nurse noticed that Charles's eyelids were fluttering. It was the story of Bobo all over again. Soon, Charles started to talk, and before a month ended, we sent him to rehab. He has made great strides ever since. In the long run, we believe he's going to be fine. Bobo won't have any seizures, but Charles may. His condition was more severe, he was older, and he didn't recover as quickly as Bobo. 6 months after the event, when I last had contact with the family, Charles had still not fully recovered, although he is active, walking and talking, and is developing a dynamic personality. Most of all, Charles's mother clearly is thankful to have her son alive. Another case I don't think I'll ever forget involved Detroit-born Danielle. 5 months old when I first saw her, she had been born with a tumor on her head that continued growing. By the time I saw Danielle, the tumor bulged out through the skull and was the same size as her head. The tumor had actually eroded the skin and pus drained out of it. Friends advised her mother, "Put your baby in an institution and let her die." "No," she said. "This is my child, my own flesh and blood." Danielle's mother was doing the Herculean task of taking care of her. 2 or 3 times each day, she changed Danielle's dressings, trying to keep the wounds clean. Danielle's mother called my office because she had read an article about me in the Ladies' Home Journal, in which it stated that I frequently did surgeries that nobody else would touch. She talked to my physician's assistant, Carol James. "Ben," Carol reported later that day, "I think this one is worth looking into." After hearing the details, I agreed. "Have the mother send me the medical records and pictures." Less than a week later, I examined everything. I realized immediately that it was a dismal situation. The brain was abnormal, the tumor had spread all over the place, and we didn't know how the skin could be closed. I called my friend Craig Dufresne, a superb plastic surgeon, and together we tried to figure out a way that we could remove the tumor and close the skull again. We also consulted Dr. Peter Phillips, one of our pediatric neuro-oncologists who specializes in treating kids with brain tumors. Together, we finally devised a way that we would actually get the tumor out. Then Dr. Dufresne would swing up muscles, skin flaps from the back and try to cover the head with them. Once that had healed, Drs. Peter Phillips and Louis Strauss would come up with a chemotherapy program to kill any remaining malignant cells. We assumed it was going to be a tough case and would require a tremendous amount of time. We were right. The operation to remove the tumor and to sew in the muscle flaps took 19 hours. We had no concern about the time, only the results. Dr. Dufresne and I tag-teamed the surgery. I needed almost half of the surgery hours to remove the tumor. Then Dufresne spent the next 9 hours covering her skull with the muscular cutaneous skin flaps. He was able to get the skin closed over. About halfway through the surgery, I said to Dufresne, "I think we're going to come out of this with our socks on." He nodded, and I could tell he felt as confident as I did. The surgery was successful. As we had anticipated, in the weeks following the removal of the tumor, Danielle had to go back to the operating room and have the flaps moved to take tension off certain areas and to improve blood circulation to the surgical site. Initially, Danielle started to do well and responded like a normal infant. I could see the pleasure her parents took in the everyday motions of babyhood most parents can take for granted. Her tiny hand grasping one of their fingers, a little smile. Then Danielle turned the corner and started going in the wrong direction. First, she had a small respiratory problem, followed by gastrointestinal problems. After we cleared them up, her kidneys reacted. We didn't know if these other problems were related to the tumor. Doctors and nurses in the pediatric ICU worked around the clock trying to keep Danielle's lungs and kidneys going. They were just as involved as we were. Finally, all that could be done had been done, and she died. We did an autopsy, and we found that the tumor had metastasized all over her lungs, kidneys, and gastrointestinal tract. Our surgery for the tumor in her head was a little too late, Had we gotten to her a month earlier, before things had metastasized, we might have been able to save her. Danielle's parents and grandparents had come from Michigan and stayed in Baltimore to be near her. During the weeks of waiting and hoping for her recovery, they had been extremely dedicated, understanding, and encouraging to us in everything we tried. When she died, I marveled at their maturity. We want it to be clear that we don't harbor any grudges over anything you folks did here at Hopkins, Danielle's parents said. We've just been incredibly thankful, said the grandmother, that you were willing to undertake a case that everyone else considered impossible anyway. Especially, I remember the words of Danielle's mother. In a voice that was barely audible, she choked back her own grief and said, We know that you're a man of God, and that the Lord has all these things in his hands. We also believe we've done everything humanly possible to save our daughter. Despite this outcome, we'll always be grateful for everything that was done here. I share Danielle's story because not all our cases are successful. I can count on my fingers the number of bad outcomes. Chapter 18. Craig and Susan. 25 to 30 people had jammed themselves into Craig Warnick's hospital room, and they were holding a prayer meeting when I walked in. All of them were taking turns asking God for a miracle when Craig went into surgery. Not only was it amazing to see so many people crowded into the room, but even more astonishing, they had all come to pray with and for Craig. I stayed a few minutes and prayed too. As I was leaving, Craig's wife, Susan, walked to the door with me. She gave me a warm smile. Remember what your mother said. I won't forget, I answered, only too aware of mother's words, because I had once quoted them to Susan. Benny, if you ask the Lord for something, believing he will do it, then he will do it. And you remember it too, I said. I believe, she said. I really do. Even without her saying so, I could read her confidence in the outcome of surgery. As I walked down the hallway, I thought of Susan and Craig and all that transpired in their lives. They had already gone through so much, and it wasn't anywhere near being over. Susan Warnick is a nurse, and an excellent one, on our children's neurosurgical floor. Her husband has a disease called von Hippel-Lindau, VHL. Individuals with this rare disease develop multiple brain tumors as well as tumors of the retina. It's a hereditary condition. Over a period of years, Craig's father had developed 4 brain tumors. Craig's ordeal began in 1974 when he was a high school senior. He learned that he had developed a tumor. Few people knew of VHL, and consequently, none of the medical professionals who examined Craig anticipated other tumors. I had not yet met Craig. Another neurosurgeon operated and took out the tumor. As I continued walking down the corridor, I thought of what he had gone through the past 13 years. Then my thoughts turned towards Susan. In her own way, she had gone through as much as Craig. I admired her for being so dedicated in taking care of Craig and making sure that everything was done for him. God had sent him the perfect mate. Susan once said that she and Craig knew from the beginning that they had a special, heaven-sent love. They met in high school when she was 14 and he was 2 years older. Neither ever considered anyone else as a lifetime partner. They both became Christians in high school through the ministry of Young Life. Since then, they have grown in their faith and are active members of their church. By the time Craig was 22, they had finally learned the name of his rare disease, including the likelihood of recurring tumors. And by then, he had undergone lung surgery, adrenalectomy, 2 brain tumor resections, and tumors of the retinas. Despite all the physical roadblocks he faced, Craig had gone on to college between his hospitalizations. After the first surgery, Craig had trouble with his balance and swallowing, both results of the tumor, and these 2 symptoms never totally left him. In 1978, Craig started vomiting and developing headaches. Both symptoms persisted with alarming regularity. Before Craig went through tests again, both he and Susan knew he had developed another tumor. However, Craig's doctor, the original physician, did not realize it was another tumor and, as the Warnicks related the story to me, the doctor dismissed their fears. The tests, however, confirmed that the Warnicks had been correct. The doctor set up a second surgery. The night before surgery, the Baltimore neurosurgeon said to Craig's mother, "I don't think I can remove the tumor without crippling him." While wanting to know the worst possible outcome, they were devastated, feeling he offered them little hope. The last thing that same doctor said to Susan on the evening of April 19, 1978, the night before his second surgery, was, "Tomorrow after surgery, he'll be in intensive care, right?" He started to walk away, and then turned back and added, "We hope he makes it." It was one of the few times when Susan struggled with doubt over Craig's recovery. Craig made it through the surgery, but he had a long list of complications, including double vision and the inability to swallow. His lack of balance was so bad, he could not even sit up. Craig was physically miserable, emotionally depressed, and ready to give up. But Susan wouldn't give up, and she refused to allow him to stop fighting. "You are going to get well," she said constantly. A few months later, Craig was admitted to the Good Samaritan Rehabilitation Hospital. Because of a number of significant factors involved, it was a miracle for Craig to get admitted. For the next 2 years, Craig had some of the best physical therapy available, and he improved dramatically. "Thank you, God," Susan, Craig, and their families prayed, offering thanks to a loving God for every sign of progress. But for Susan and Craig, improvement was not enough. "Heavenly Father," they prayed daily, "make Craig well." Craig had a bad time recovering and faced a variety of setbacks. No longer a husky young man, Craig lost 75 pounds, making him nothing but skin stretched over a nearly 6-foot frame. Craig continued to improve, but he still had a long way to go. He learned to feed himself. Mainly because of his trouble with swallowing, he needed an hour and a half for a meal. He couldn't walk and had to be in a wheelchair. Yet during that recovery period, showing remarkable determination, he continued in college. The faith of those two was remarkable, especially Susan's. "He's going to walk," she told people. "Craig is going to walk again." After 2 years of physical therapy with the aid of a cane, Craig walked down the aisle with Susan, and they were married on June 7, 1980. The Baltimore Sun wrote a big story about this loving relationship and how it had pulled Craig from the jaws of death. Craig threw himself into his college courses and finally completed his work. He graduated in January 1981 and found a job with the federal government, filling a handicap quota. But it wasn't all good news. In late 1981, Craig developed tumors in his adrenal glands. In surgery, the glands were removed, and he is now on medication for the rest of his life. Shortly afterward, Susan met with Dr. Neil Miller, an ophthalmologist at Johns Hopkins, who told her, "At least you now have a name for the disease. It's called Van Hippel-Lindau, or VHL. He smiled. "It's named for the men who discovered it." He handed Susan an article about the disease. As she started to read, Dr. Miller told her that Von Hippel-Lindau disease strikes one person in 50,000. Characteristically, VHL causes tumors in the lung, kidneys, heart, spleen, liver, adrenal glands, and pancreas. In that instant, Susan grasped the impact this disease would have on the rest of Craig's life. She stopped reading, and her gaze met that of Dr. Miller's. Both of them were teary-eyed. She later said, "His crying did more to comfort me than anything he could have said. I was so impressed to discover that there were people in the medical profession who felt deeply for their patients. His crying openly made me feel he understood and that he cared." Susan then knew the name and characteristics of the disease. That knowledge also helped her to know what they could expect in the future. More tumors. "This disease isn't going to go away. This next surgery won't be the end of it," she said, more to herself than to Dr. Miller. "We are going to have to live with this for a lifetime, aren't we?" Tears again filled his eyes. He nodded as he said hoarsely, "At least you know what you're dealing with now." Susan decided not to give Craig this information. Craig is quiet by nature, and at the time he was severely depressed. She thought that if he knew the bleakness of his future, this would only add to his heavy heart. She kept the information to herself, but she was not satisfied. She had to know more. For the next 18 months, Susan read, researched, and wrote to anyone whom she thought might give any additional information. Susan claims to have one of the largest VHL libraries in the world, and I believe her. She telephoned across the United States, finding the places where they were actually doing VHL research. Over the course of Craig's illness, Susan has become highly knowledgeable about VHL and keeps abreast of medical developments. VHL is associated with a preventable form of blindness. Because it is a dominantly inherited disease, this means that 50% of the offspring of persons with VHL will eventually develop it. Craig's sister had a tumor when she was in her 20s. It appears she will not have any more. When she finally told Craig about VHL, he said simply, "I knew something serious was wrong, and the tumors kept coming back." About that time, Susan remembered how much Dr. Miller's compassion had enabled her to cope. As she thought about her experience, she concluded that nurses could benefit patients by expressing their care. It was then that she decided to enter nurses' training. After graduating in 1984, Susan applied for and received a job in the pediatric neurology department at Johns Hopkins, where she has remained since. To no one's surprise, Susan is an excellent nurse. In September 1986, Susan realized he was showing symptoms of yet another brain tumor. That's when I came into the picture. Susan asked me to take Craig as a patient. After I agreed, we did a CT scan, and I had to tell them that it appeared that he actually had 3 tumors. After some preparation, I removed the tumors, and fortunately, he didn't have any surgical complications. He did, however, have endocrinological problems, which required several weeks to regulate. A little while later, Craig developed another tumor in the center of the brain with a cyst in it. A gifted chief resident named Art Wong assisted me. We had a difficult operation because we had to split the corpus callosum that connects the 2 halves of the brain and go right down to the center to get the thing out. The operation went well with no problems. Craig did fine postoperatively. They were praying that this would be the last surgery while knowing the statistics worked against them. Craig continued to recover, slowly but markedly. Then, in 1988, came the dreaded news. Craig had developed another tumor, this one in his brainstem. It was in the pons, an area considered inoperable, yet someone had to try. Craig and Susan asked me to do the surgery. "I'm sorry," I told them. "I just can't fit Craig into my operating schedule." As Susan well knew, I was already backed up with patients. Even though I believed I made the right choice, I felt terrible having to say no. "I'd like to have you go to one of the other neurosurgeons here at Hopkins who specializes in vascular problems," I said, "because the tumors are vascular." "We'd really like you to do it," Craig said in his quiet voice. "If there's any way possible," Susan said. "We know how busy you are, and we understand." After a lengthy discussion and using all my persuasion, Craig did transfer to the other surgeon's care. This man considered using a new procedure, called the gamma knife. However, after talking with the Swedish inventor of the procedure, he decided it probably wouldn't work on Craig's particular type of tumor. They would have to rethink their options. In the meantime, Craig started to deteriorate rapidly. He lost the ability to swallow, having developed such weakness in his face that it felt numb, and he started having severe headaches. On June 19, 1988, Craig had to be admitted through the hospital emergency room. Susan called me. As I listened, I knew I couldn't stand by and let him get worse. I had to do something. I paused as I tried to sort out my emotional reaction from my professionalism. I heard myself saying, "Okay, I'm going to bump somebody off the schedule. We'll get Craig into surgery." We scheduled him for the next day, June 20th, at 6 p.m. Both of them became ecstatic. I don't think I've ever seen 2 happier people. It seemed that just knowing I would do the surgery gave them a greater sense of peace. "It's all in God's hands," I told them. "But we believe you let God use your hands," Craig said. Although I had consented to do the surgery, I had to explain to Craig and Susan that this tumor and cyst were probably in the brainstem. "I can't tell for sure until I go inside and investigate," I said. "And if it's in the brainstem..." I paused, not wanting to tell them I wouldn't be able to do anything. "We understand," Craig said. Susan nodded. They grasped the odds they were facing. But, I added, any part of the tumor not in the brainstem, I'll take out. It's going to be all right, Susan said, and she meant it. It felt a little strange having the patient's wife encourage me for me to be on the receiving end of morale boosting. Although I agreed to the surgery, I still did not know the best course of action. I had bandied some thoughts around and I consulted other neurosurgeons. Nobody knew what to do about this particular tumor. I'm going to go in there and at least investigate, I finally said. I didn't promise the Warnix anything. How could I? They didn't seem to need any kind of extra assurance. They were more at peace than I was. It was the late afternoon before surgery when I found all those praying people gathered in Craig's room. It was a tough operation. The tumor had so many abnormal blood vessels coming to and going from it that I had to use a microscope to see precisely where the tumor began so I could remove it. I looked up and down the brainstem at every angle, but couldn't find anything except that his brainstem was badly swollen. I thought, the tumor's got to be in there within the brainstem. So I stuck needles into the brainstem. The brainstem is considered untouchable because it has so many important structures and fibers that even the slightest irritation can cause major complications. I had already suspected that the tumor might have a cyst in it. If so, if I could reach the cyst and withdraw some fluid, it would release some of the pressure on Craig's brain. I did not find a cyst, but instead provoked terrific bleeding from the sites of the needle punctures. I couldn't get anything else to come out. After 8 hours, sometime around 2:30 in the morning, we closed Craig up and sent him back to the ICU. He had gone through a lot, and I assumed he'd be totally wiped out. I was astonished when I walked into the room the next morning. Craig behaved as if he were preoperative. Although lying in bed, he was smiling, moving around, even making jokes. Once past my shock, I told Susan and him that I thought this tumor was clearly in the middle of the pons, part of the brainstem. I'm willing to open the pons up, I said, but I couldn't do it last night because I'd already been operating on it for 8 hours, and I was tired. I probably wouldn't be thinking right. I like to make sure I have all my faculties working when venturing into no man's land, something I just don't want to attempt in the middle of the night. Do it, Craig said. There isn't much choice, is there? Susan asked. There is at least a 50-50 chance that Craig will die right on the table, I told Susan and Craig. Those weren't easy words to say, and yet I had to tell them all of the facts, especially the unpleasant one. And if he doesn't die, he could be paralyzed or devastated neurologically. We understand, Susan said. We want you to go ahead anyway. We are praying for a miracle. We believe God is going to do it through you. What have we got to lose? Craig added. Otherwise, it's death anyway. I scheduled the surgery for a few days later. Although I'd known Craig and Susan were both strong Christians more than at any other time, I saw it evidenced then. They kept saying, "We want a miracle, and we believe we're going to get one. We're praying for God to give us one." An orderly wheeled Craig to the operating room, and the procedure began. Craig lay face down on the operating table, his head held tight onto a frame so it couldn't move. Once again, doctors shaved and scrubbed his head. A nurse placed a sterile drape over Craig, with a small plastic window over the surgical site, and the surgery began. Again, it was tough going. Eventually, I got down to the side of the brainstem. "I'm going to open up a little hole in the brainstem," I murmured to my staff. I took a bipolar instrument, a small electrical coagulating instrument, and opened up the brainstem. It began to bleed profusely. Every time I touched the stem, it bled. My assistant continued to suction up the blood to keep the site clear while I asked myself, "What do I do now?" I prayed silently and fervently, "God, help me know what to do." I always pray before any of the operations, as I scrub, standing at the table before I begin. This time, I was acutely conscious of praying during the entire surgery as I kept thinking, "Lord, it's up to you. You gotta do something here." I had no idea what to try. I paused and stared into space as I said to God, "Craig will die unless you show me what to do." Within seconds, I knew. A kind of intuitive knowledge filled my mind. "Let me have the laser," I said to the technician. I asked for a laser beam simply because it seemed like the most logical choice. Using the laser, cautiously, I tried opening a little hole in the brainstem. The laser enabled me to coagulate some of the bleeding vessels as I went in. At last, I got a tiny hole opened with minimum bleeding and went inside. Feeling something abnormal, I teased out a little piece of it. It was probably tumorous, but it was stuck. I tugged gently, but nothing came out. Again, I hesitated, not wanting to become too aggressive. I couldn't open up the hole any larger because I was right down at the brainstem. The anesthesiologists checked their evoked potential monitors, which showed the electrical activity coming from the brain. "The evoked potentials are gone," one of them said. The evoked potential had died, just the way an EKG goes flat when the heart stops beating. This flatness indicated no brain waves or activity on one side of his brain, a sign of severe damage. The brain operates on electrical activity, and the activity coming through the brainstem on that side was gone, although the other side remained undamaged. "We're in here. We're going to persist," I said, not allowing myself to consider how severe the damage might be. "God, I just can't give up. Please guide my hands." I kept at the tiny hole in the stem, my hands easing, pleading, begging, pulling gently. Finally, the tumorous growth started coming out. Gently I tugged, and suddenly it all came free in one gigantic blob. Immediately, the brainstem shrunk back closer to its normal size, but while I felt pleased that I'd gotten the growth, the damage to Craig had been done. Although I tried to keep from thinking about what would happen, I knew too well. Even if Craig did survive, which was highly unlikely, he would be a total train wreck. He would certainly be comatose and likely paralyzed. Yet I had kept on because I knew it was the right thing to do. The surgery continued for 4 more hours. When we closed up, I felt terrible. Aloud, I said, "Well, we did our best." I knew I had, but my words brought me no comfort. The next part of the story is told by Susan, who later taped a record of Craig's story, including her experience during the first 1988 surgery that I have just described. Susan Warnick. A lot of friends and family members came to stay with me during the surgery that night, and I was thankful for their presence. When people weren't talking to me, I spent most of the time reading my Bible. I wanted to trust God and push away all my doubts. But the doubts were there, gnawing at me. I couldn't grasp what was happening or understand why I was falling to pieces. I had had real confidence in God for such a long time. I was so certain that we would have a miracle. Over the years, any time Craig showed signs of discouragement, I was there to motivate him, to let him know I was with him, and that we could face anything together because God was in charge of our lives. I had been so strong, and now I was falling apart. That night, nothing snapped me out of my depression. I remember saying to some of the people in the room, "I've never said this before or felt this way before either, but right this minute, I feel totally defeated. Maybe God wants me to understand that enough is enough. Maybe Craig and I can't handle this anymore. Maybe it's best if it ends this way." Naturally, they tried to comfort me, but I could do nothing but wait and worry. Sometime in the middle of the night, I looked up and saw Dr. Carson coming into the waiting room where I sat with my family. He explained about the location of the tumor, the brain damage, and said something like, "As I said before, this was likely to happen. At best, Craig will probably live a few more months and then die." Dr. Carson has a reputation of being unflappable and showing no emotion when he talks to families. He has a soft, kind voice, so quiet that many times people have to strain to hear him. Most of all, he is always so calm. I held myself rigid as I listened to what amounted to Craig's death sentence. The more Dr. Carson told me, the more upset I became. I didn't cry, but my whole body started trembling. I was aware of this shaking, and the more I tried to control it, the more convulsive it became. "Craig is going to die." Over and over, that sentence rang through my head. Dr. Carson did say that he would try to remove this tumor if Craig and I were willing to go back to surgery again. But he also told me that Craig would definitely be paralyzed on one side of his body, and there's a possibility that he will die. For a few minutes, I hardly noticed Ben Carson or heard anything. Craig was going to die. After that, nothing much registered. Dr. Carson was standing in front of me, trying to comfort me, and I knew we could never find the words that would bring me peace. After 14 years of researching VHL and having it drilled into my head that if Craig ever had a tumor in his pons, he would die, I knew what was happening. My Craig, I was going to lose him. Craig was going to die. The tumor was in the middle of the pons, Dr. Carson repeated. At that moment, I looked up and saw Dr. Benjamin Carson, the human being. Naturally, he was tired, and I could see the weariness around his eyes, but it was more than that. This isn't the way he usually looks, I thought. Something's different about him. Then I knew. Dr. Carson was discouraged, defeated. I realized that I had been so caught up with my own confusion and pain, I had only thought of Craig and me, never considering what might be going on inside Dr. Carson. Here was a man who masked his emotions well, and yet he wasn't doing it well right then. I thought, this man removes half of people's brains. He does surgical procedures no one else can do. Yet I read a sadness in his face, a look of despair. Momentarily, I forgot about Craig and myself, and I felt sorry for the doctor. He had tried hard, and now he was frustrated and really down. He finished talking, turned, and walked down the hall. As I watched him, I kept saying to myself, I feel so sorry for him. I ran down the hall and caught up with him. I hugged him and said, Don't feel so bad, Ben. I went back to the room. A patient had gone home that day, and the nurses let me spend the night in the unused room. As I lay on the bed, I stared at the ceiling. I was angry, so angry. I couldn't remember feeling that much emotion at any time before. God, I whispered in the semi-darkness, we've been through so much. We've seen a lot of positive things come out of all of this. Even though I've had moments when it was difficult for me, especially in our early years together, this is the worst. I'm mad at you, God. You're going to let Craig die and do nothing about it. If you were going to take him, why didn't you do it in 1981, or when he had his first tumor? If you're so loving, how can you let a person like Craig go through this much only to end up dying? Nothing makes sense anymore. You're going to make me a widow at 30. Craig and I will never even have a child. I recalled other women who had lost their husbands, telling me that having children after their husband's death gave them a purpose, a reason to live. They at least have children. I don't have anything. I hurt so deeply inside, I wanted to die. A few minutes later, I went into the bathroom and saw my reflection in a mirror. I didn't recognize the face that stared back at me. It was such a weird experience, and I stared at the stranger before me. I walked back to the bed, more miserable than ever. I felt as if my whole life had been a mistake. Useless, that's me. All the effort, all the caring, for nothing. And how can I live without Craig? How can you expect me to go on without him? The venom poured out of me. I blamed God for putting me in the position of making Craig my whole world. Now God was going to take him. I cried and let my anger spew out. Exhausted, I finally stopped talking. In a moment of quietness, God told me something. Not a voice, and yet definitely words. Craig is not yours that you should demand to keep him. He doesn't belong to you, Susan. He is mine. As the truth came through to me, I realized how foolish I had been. Craig and I had surrendered our lives to Jesus Christ back in high school. Both of us belonged to God, and I had no right to try to hold on now. Only a few days before, I had been listening to a Christian radio program. The preacher told the story of Abraham taking Isaac up the mountain and of his willingness to sacrifice him, the person Abraham loved most in life. I thought of that story and said, Yes, God, Craig is my Isaac, and like Abraham, I want to offer him up to you. As I lay on the neat hospital bed, a wave of peace slowly washed over me, and I slept. Ben Carson. The afternoon following the second brainstem surgery, I was making my rounds and went in to see Craig. I couldn't believe it. He was sitting up in bed. I stared at him several seconds, and then, to cover my amazement, I said, "Move your right arm." He moved it. "Now your left." Again, quite normal reactions. I asked him to move his feet and anything else I could think of. Everything was normal. I couldn't explain how he could be normal, but he was. Craig still had problems with swallowing, but everything else seemed okay. "I guess God had something to do with this," I said. "I guess God had everything to do with it," he answered. The next morning, we were able to remove the breathing tube. "Going to empty me out?" Craig laughed. He was cracking jokes, having a fine time out of all of this. "You got your miracle, Craig," I said. "I know." His face glowed. I was at home with my family one evening about 6 weeks later when the phone rang. As soon as Susan recognized my voice, without bothering to identify herself, she shouted, "Dr. Carson, you won't believe what just happened. Craig ate a whole plate of spaghetti and meatballs. He ate it all, and he swallowed everything. That was more than a half an hour ago, and he's feeling great." We talked for some time, and it felt good to know that I had been a part of their lives during one of their special moments. It made me think of how we take simple things for granted, like the ability to swallow. Only people like Craig and Susan understand how wonderful this is. Chapter 19. Separating the Twins. "I wanted to kill them and myself as well," Teresa Binder said. In January 1987, during her 8th month of pregnancy, the 20-year-old woman received the terrible news. She would give birth to Siamese twins. Siamese twins occur once in every 70,000 to 100,000 births. Twins joined at the head occur only once in 2 to 2.5 million births. Siamese twins received their name because of the birthplace, Siam, of Chang and Eng, 1811 through 1874, whom P.T. Barnum exhibited across America and Europe. Most craniopagus Siamese twins die at birth or shortly afterward. So far as we know, not more than 50 attempts had previously been made to separate such twins. Of those, less than 10 operations have resulted in 2 fully normal children. Aside from the skill of the operating surgeons, the success depends largely on how much and what kind of tissue the babies share. Occipital craniopagus twins, such as the Binders, had never before been separated, with both surviving. Other Siamese twins joined at the hip or chest had been done successfully. Even so, when any 2 children are born with their bodies together, an attempt to separate them is an extremely delicate operation with chances of survival normally no greater than 50-50. The twins share certain biosystems and, if damaged, would result in both their deaths. "Oh my God," she cried. "This can't be true. I'm not having twins. I'm having a sick, ugly monster." She wept almost continuously for the next 3 days. In her pain, this mother-to-be contemplated every possible way to avoid giving birth to the twins. Teresa first thought of overdosing on sleeping pills to kill the unborn twins and herself. "I just couldn't go on, and for a while it seemed like the only solution for them and for me." But when she actually faced this answer, she couldn't bring herself to swallow the pills. Some of her thoughts bordered on the bizarre, contemplating something, anything, just to have peace and to get herself out of this nightmare. She had considered running away, jumping out of the window of a tall building. No matter what she contemplated, she heard herself saying, "I just want to die." On the 4th morning, Teresa suddenly realized that she could kill herself. That would be bad enough, but that by her suicide she was murdering 2 other beings who had the right to live. Teresa Binder made peace with herself, knowing that she would have to face whatever happened. Now she could move beyond the tragedy and live with the results, other parents had. Yet only months before, Teresa and her 36-year-old husband, Joseph, were overjoyed at the prospect of a baby. Early in her pregnancy, her doctor informed them that she was carrying twins. "I was filled with joy," Teresa recalled, "and thanked God for this wonderful double gift." In anticipation, this couple in Ulm, West Germany, bought identical baby clothes, a double cradle, and a double baby carriage as they awaited the twins' arrival. The twins, Patrick and Benjamin, were born by cesarean section on February 2, 1987. Together they weighed a total of 8 pounds, 14